Our subject this morning is the Day of Jehovah. There's a lot in the prophecies, New Testament as well as Old, on the Day of Jehovah, although in the New Testament it's the Day of the Lord, because Jehovah is not used in the New Testament writings that we have. What is the Day of Jehovah? Well, there are a lot of scriptures, and we're going to look at some of them in Joel. There's more than we're going to cover today, but we also want to know not just what is the Day of Jehovah, and why is it? Well, then we'll talk about some more details about it, and perhaps most important to us, what should we be doing about it? From Joel, the second chapter, beginning with the first verse, perhaps this is the best known of them all. Blow ye the trumpet in Zion, and sound an alarm in my holy mountain. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of Jehovah cometh, for it is nigh at hand, a day of darkness and gloominess, a day of clouds and thick darkness. Bob, maybe you and some of the rest of us can remember the last couple of days here with all of that smoke. So, people cannot see clearly. Can the world see clearly what's going on today? As the dawn spread upon the mountains. I've had that described to me, that you can have a clear night, clear, cold night, and the dew is on the ground, and when the sun first comes up, it starts to evaporate that dew, and you get a heavy fog, which is very dark, even after sunrise. But then, in time, it evaporates, the vapor goes away, and you get to see clearly late in the day. A great people and a strong. There hath not been ever the like. Neither shall be any more after them. And isn't that a relief? No more after them. Even to the years of many generations. A fire devoureth before them, and behind them a flame burneth. The land is as the Garden of Eden before them, and behind them a desolate wilderness. Yea, and none hath escaped them. And behind them is a desolate wilderness. That could suggest any one of things. Perhaps the firebombing of Dresden, where they bombed all of the outer neighborhoods, driving the people to the civic center, and then they firebombed the bomb shelters there. I remember one saying, as soon as the bombing was ended, and we heard the screams, we ran to the bomb shelter and started to dig them out. And the planes came again, and after that, it was silence. Yea, and none hath escaped them. Now, it could also imply something like Agent Orange that was used in Vietnam. It was a rainforest before the Agent Orange, and it defoliated the rainforest there. Or perhaps it's talking about atom bombs and hydrogen bombs, or all of the above. We'll turn for a moment to Amos 5:18. Woe unto you that desire the day of Jehovah. Wherefore would ye have the day of Jehovah? It is darkness and not light. Does that describe us today? An era in which they say, we have light as never before. This is the brain age. And yet, they do the stupidest things. Continuing further, in Joel chapter 3, starting with the 14th verse. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision. For the day of Jehovah is near in the valley of decision. The sun and the moon are darkened, and the stars withdraw their shining. I'll suggest here it may be talking about the sun and the moon as the brighter light in the New Testament, and the moon that reflects it in the Old Testament. And the stars withdraw their shining, the preachers, and perhaps the rabbis. There's a lot of uncertainty in the denominations today, isn't there? Mm-hmm. Now, someone may object, if you make the stars preachers, then why shouldn't the sun and the moon be individuals? And that may be, in which case the sun and the moon would be Jesus or Jehoshua in the Hebrew, and Moses or Moshe in the Hebrew. Continuing on in verse 16, "And Jehovah will roar from Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem, and the heavens and the earth shall shake." The heavens and the earth shall shake. Doesn't that remind us of some things in the New Testament too? Perhaps we'll get there. "But Jehovah will be a refuge unto his people and a stronghold to the children of Israel." From this point on, we seem to be talking about the millennial age, the millennial resurrection kingdom. "So shall ye know that I am Jehovah your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. Then shall Jerusalem be holy, and there shall be no strangers passing through her any more." That will surely be in the kingdom age. We go now to Matthew 24, 29 and 30. "But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun shall be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven." That sounds a lot like the prophecy from Joel 3, doesn't it? "And the powers of the heavens shall be shaken." The powers of the heavens, meaning the demons of the present age. And who is the god of this world but Satan himself? We might turn to Haggai 2, verses 6 and 7, as we interrupt the context here. Haggai 2, verses 6 and 7. "For thus saith Jehovah of hosts, yet once it is a little while, and I will shake the heavens and the earth, and the sea, and the dry land, and I will shake all nations, and the precious things of all nations shall come, and I will fill this house with glory, saith Jehovah of hosts." But first, the shaking of the nations. Are nations shaken up? Something happens in the Eastern Hemisphere, whether it's North Korea or Iran, does this country shake? And we have it repeated for us in Hebrews 12, verses 26 and 27. Hebrews 12, 26 and 7. "His voice then shook the earth, but now he hath promised, saying, yet once more will I make to tremble not the earth only, but also the heaven. And this word, yet once more, signifieth the removing of those things that are shaken, as of things which have been made, that those things which are not shaken may remain." God's heavens cannot be shaken, can they? We should not be shaken. I'll admit it's a little difficult to avoid it these days, isn't it? Nevertheless, "And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven." And what is the sign of the Son of Man in heaven? What would be a sign sufficient to convince the world as to what is going on or will be going on? And I will suggest that that will be the resurrection of the dead. Can you imagine somebody in Jordan, and he's saying towards the latter part of Armageddon, I don't understand what's going on here. We are getting sick, we are dying, we have pestilence, and what's this that we hear over on the other side of the Jordan River, that people are coming back from the dead? They're even saying that our father Abraham is back from the dead. Now just maybe it might be a good idea to go over there and listen to what they have to say. And then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming. By the way, that is the word, erkomai, to come, not to be present here. And they shall see the Son of Man coming on the clouds, or in the clouds, or in a cloud, depending on whether it's Matthew, Luke, or Mark. They shall see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Now, of course, if an airplane is coming on the clouds or in a cloud, we don't see it. And the world doesn't know what's going on, or whatever it is hidden from them. So I would not expect that our Lord would be visible in his second presence if he's coming in the cloud. Like it's written in Acts at his ascension, and a cloud received him out of their sight. Okay. But this business about shall all the tribes mourn? Well, for that we go to Zechariah chapter 12. And we'll start with the 10th verse. In fact, that's the principal one. So I think we'll settle for just that. And I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication. And they shall look unto me. That's better than upon me. They shall look unto me whom they have pierced. That would be Jesus, of course. And they shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn. Is Jesus not the firstborn? So the mourning is not in connection with Armageddon, but the mourning is for the one who died for you and for me and for Adam and hence for all. Zechariah tells us only that Israel will be mourning for Christ. But here we have in Matthew, all the tribes of the earth shall mourn. Not only Israel, but all the tribes of the earth mourning for Christ. Because which one of them has stood up for Jesus? The farther we get into this last day of the gospel age, the more we understand that nations, all nations, are not happy with Christianity in any form. But the time will come when all nations will realize that they have gone against Christ. Even Israel, for that matter. But the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven, yes, not seen, with power and great glory. That's what brings us to the resurrection kingdom. More scriptures. Now from Zephaniah, let's see. Zephaniah chapter 1, beginning with the 7th verse. Actually, it goes into chapter 2, verse 3. Don't know that we'll read all of that, but we'll skip just a little bit. Hold thy peace at the presence of the Lord Jehovah, for the day of Jehovah is at hand. For Jehovah hath prepared a sacrifice, he hath consecrated his guests. It sounds kind of like the Christians of the gospel age, doesn't it? The consecrated guests. And the sacrifice? Well, that's what makes it possible for any of us. The sacrifice of Christ. He's prepared a sacrifice, he has consecrated his guests. And it shall come to pass in the day of Jehovah's sacrifice that I will punish the princes and the king's sons and all such as are clothed with foreign apparel. 12th verse. And it shall come to pass at that time that I will search Jerusalem with lamps, and I will punish the men that are settled on their lees, that say in their heart, Jehovah will not do good, neither will he do evil. How much of the world has that attitude today? I can do anything I want because God isn't going to do anything. The great, in the 14th verse, the great day of Jehovah is near. It is near and hasteth greatly. Even the voice of the day of Jehovah, the mighty man crieth here bitterly. Sounds a lot like Joel 2 that we just read earlier. That day is a day of wrath. It identifies the day of wrath with the day of Jehovah. A day of trouble, time of trouble and distress. A day of wasteness and desolation. A day of darkness and gloominess. A day of clouds and thick darkness. The world doesn't know what's going on. They only dread it. A day of the trumpet and alarm against the fortified cities and against the high battlements. And I will bring distress upon men, and they shall walk like blind men, because they have sinned against Jehovah. And their blood shall be poured out as dust, and their flesh as dung. When, but since the 1870s, has any mass murderer killed more than 5 million people? Yet just 3 men in the 20th century have murdered 100 million people. Yes, number 3 is Adolf Hitler. Number 2 is Joseph Stalin. And number 1, Chairman Mao. Neither their silver nor their gold shall be able to deliver them in the day of Jehovah's wrath. Neither their silver nor their gold. The West, and perhaps particularly America, have been depending upon the great wealth to deliver them. On a smaller scale, it didn't work too well in Vietnam, because under communism, who you know had more to do with how much you had. Now, concerning the times and the seasons, brethren, ye have no need that aught be written unto you. This is from 1 Thessalonians 5. For yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so cometh as a thief in the night. When a thief comes in the night, he's pretty secretive, isn't he? Otherwise, he's not a very bright thief. When they are saying peace and safety, then sudden destruction cometh upon them as travail upon a woman with child. At that point, there's no turning back. And they shall in no wise escape. When they are saying peace and safety, I think it was 1913 they built the Peace Palace in The Hague. And we know what happened beginning in the following year. And in 1938, British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain comes back to the airport waving these two papers, peace in our time. And instead, the next year, instead of peace, there were pieces. But the heavens that now are, and the earth, by the same word, have been stored up for fire, being reserved against the day of judgment and destruction of ungodly men. Well, okay, the day of Jehovah, then, is at least a part of the day of judgment. And I think we can probably say the day of Jehovah, well, it begins with the parousia, begins at the beginning of the last day. It continues on to the end of the 1,000 years, up to the loosing of Satan. But forget not this one thing, beloved, that one day is with the Lord as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. Okay, just a little side note that it can be reasonably asked here. Does that mean that it is exactly 1,000 years? Some will answer yes, and some not necessarily. And 1,000 years are as one day. Well, to say it's as 1,000 years is not quite the same as saying it is 1,000 years. But that can be discussed civilly by some people. Verse 9. The Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering to youward, or toward you, not wishing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. Not willing that any should perish. What does that mean to you and to me? It means like, even if things seem to be going chaotic pretty fast, each and every one of us is going to have all the time he needs to make his calling and election sure. Not 1 hour shaved off. Not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. But the day of the Lord will have come as a thief. Now that's interesting. That's something that Rotherham catches that many of the translations do not. Many of the translations will say, the day of the Lord shall come or will come. But literally, it is a future perfect tense. The Lord will have come as a thief, meaning there's activity going on even after his return, in the which the heavens shall pass away with great noise, is what's called Christianity today, going away quietly, not going down without a loud noise. And the evidence shall be dissolved, the elements shall be dissolved with fervent heat. Those people that were in Hiroshima and Nagasaki could really appreciate what that can mean. And the earth and the works that are therein shall be exposed. That's the literal meaning of the word. Some translations say, shall be burned up, because they use the later manuscripts. But the earlier manuscripts indicate pretty strongly, shall be discovered or shall be exposed. And is that what's going on today? Politicians and a whole bunch of other people are being exposed. Some of them so-called Christian leaders. Now, if I do wrong, then I can expect to be exposed also. We turn now to Zechariah chapter 14. Behold, a day of Jehovah cometh, when thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half of the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then I might just pause there just for a moment. All nations are to be gathered against Jerusalem in battle. Are all nations against Israel today? Can you name one that isn't? That's right. And also, though, when this country moved its embassy to Jerusalem, it wound up being, I think, only the third country to do so. Guatemala was ahead of it, and I think maybe some other Latin American country in that neighborhood was also. So there are very few. And Canada, under Stephen Harper. And although I can't say Angela Merkel in Germany was entirely bright about it, she was definitely not intending to be anti-Israel. So when the time is riper, all nations will be gathered against Jerusalem to battle. And it says, and half the city shall go forth into captivity. We'll compare that with Isaiah 66:20. This is now going into the kingdom, because some things happen about those that escape to Tarshish, Pul, and Lud, and so forth. And then it says in verse 20, the last chapter of Isaiah, and they shall bring all your brethren out of all the nations for an oblation unto Jehovah, upon horses, and in chariots, and in litters, and upon mules, and upon dromedaries, to my holy mountain, Jerusalem,
saith Jehovah, as the children of Israel bring their oblation in a clean vessel into the house of Jehovah.
This sometimes can seem a little puzzling. How is it that the Lord will bring back all or almost all of the Jews to Israel, and yet they shall be bringing them back from the nations, bringing them back in style, willingly? And yet, it can be from the scriptures we're reading here in Zechariah. If half the city goes into captivity, then they will be there to be brought back from captivity. So we'll wait to see if it works out that way. Zechariah 14, starting with verse 3. Then shall Jehovah go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle. Verse 6. And it shall come to pass in that day that the light shall not be bright nor dark. The bright ones shall withdraw themselves. We remember in those previous prophecies that about the stars shall be darkened. Now, question may be asked, why would you say that the stars aren't literal stars? Well, there's a couple of reasons. One is, each one of those stars is physically a whole lot bigger than the earth or the sun. But if you go to Hollywood to see the stars, are you looking up at the sky? Similarly here, the stars of the heavens then would be religious leaders, and that would seem to be a rational explanation. But the bright ones shall withdraw themselves, those who are preaching that the earth will be burned up and nothing will be left living on the earth, and a few will go to heaven, and the whole rest of the world will go into eternal torture. What will they be able to preach in the kingdom? But it shall be one day, that I think would be the millennial day. It shall be one day which is known unto Jehovah, the day of Jehovah. Not day and not night, but it shall come to pass that towards evening time there shall be light. Well, that's not the way it generally works in our world. All the time we've been living, noon is the time when it's brightest. But with the millennial day, it's coming out of darkness, and at first there's a whole lot of confusion among the peoples around the world. But as they are taught the ways of righteousness, and they learn the ways of righteousness by practicing righteousness, it will come to pass that the farther we get to the end of the 1,000 years, the brighter it will be. And it shall come to pass in that day that living waters shall go out from Jerusalem, half of them towards the eastern sea and half of them towards the western sea. In summer and in winter it shall be. And Jehovah shall be king over all the earth. In that day shall Jehovah be one and his name one. Minor comment, not three, but one. Now, half of these living waters go out from Jerusalem. There's about half of the world's population that are east of Israel and about half that are west of Israel. Now, it's our custom that when we get to spring, the waters are in the rivers, including the wash behind our house. But as the summer goes along, they dry up and dry up until there's little, if anything, down at the bottom. And then winter comes and the rain comes and the water comes. But this is making the point that in summer and in winter it shall be. Throughout the millennial kingdom, there will be no drying up of the rivers of water of life. And this is an interesting expression, living waters. Our word for it is running waters. Now, but did you ever see waters run like you and I do? But the idea of moving waters is living waters. And these are the waters of life in the kingdom. the millennial resurrection kingdom. So, summarizing, for 17 centuries, the sins of Babylon and her daughters, for 14 centuries, the sins of Islam and its divisions, and now for one century, the sins of hard left atheism have been ruling by fear, with immorality, oppression, murder, and lying. The day of Jehovah, the day of wrath, the day of vengeance, the day of judgment, has come due in our day. These sins are being exposed. The world doesn't know what's happening. A day of clouds and thick darkness. We see abominable lying against Israel. And anyone who speaks for Israel and against those who oppose Israel is accused of hate speech. We see abominable lying against Israel, which will lead to all nations opposing Israel. How many governments do you know that tell the truth, at least usually even? Do you trust the Arab governments to do that? Or would you more likely trust what you hear coming out of Jerusalem? But there is to be a bright future in the day of Jehovah. Now, according to Edmund Burke, George Orwell first. He says it rather nicely. The most effective way to destroy people is to deny and obliterate their own understanding of their history. See this taking place in the schools today? How much do people know about what the history is of this country? I have just enough time to mention something that I thought I knew something about the days of slavery. And so when I was in Nigeria, I asked Nelson Bassi what it was like when the British ships came in and took the slaves. And he looks at me like, what planet did you grow up on? And then he explained that slaves, that's in the history of Nigeria. And after Islam was established, they bought the slaves from Nigeria and took them north across the Sahara Desert to the Arab countries. I didn't exactly treat them too nicely. That was from Thomas Sowell. But he said, really, when the British ships came in, they simply offered a higher price. That's all. And he says the source of it was a man would get into trouble. He'd get into debt. And so he would say to his wife, you need a new carpet. I know that. So come with me here to the market, and you stay here while I go down and negotiate the price. So he would negotiate with the merchant there, and he would receive the money from the merchant. He would disappear, and then they'd grab her wife as a slave. Or he might sell his children in order to pay the debt. That kind of left me a little out of breath. It was not what I'd expected the history was at all. Because they don't teach that here that I know of. Well, that's just one example of obliterating our understanding of history. And as Edmund Burke said, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. Now, today, political correctness is rewriting history. But not alone, the Islamists do too. They entirely rewrite the history of Palestine, don't they? When Mark Twain was over there 150 years ago, he wrote about what a desolate land it was. And now the Arabs, Arab Muslims tell us that, oh, it was a beautiful paradise until the Jews came in. And now look at it. Yesterday, it was Hitler and Stalin that were remaking history. And before that, Rome. They all used the big lie technique. Repeat it often enough, and people will swallow it. Now, those who have the guiltiest consciences are the quickest to accuse others. Have we noticed that? For one example, consider a divorce case. I was on the way home from work one time several years ago, and this focus on the family came up, and this was the example he was using, was divorce case. It's not limited to that at all. He says, in the case of a divorce, there'll usually be one of the two that is doing most of the accusing of the other. So, you know immediately, that's the guiltier party. After all, the innocent one doesn't feel driven to defend himself. Atheism has no inherent reason to distinguish right from wrong, only survival of the fittest. Another characteristic of the day is the lack of gratitude. And without gratitude, there is unhappiness and continual anger. Do we see this in the world today? Do we hear it in the news? Do we see a world of angry people today? The question for you and for me is, what should we do? First, let us be grateful for what we have and for the future prospects in the resurrection. Let us gain an objective view of history, and the Bible is true, including our own history. Repent and make restitution to the extent that we are able, and ask for forgiveness. Let us live truthful in an untruthful world. The world thinks telling the truth is a symbol of weakness, but rather the contrary. When untruth is the norm, telling the truth is an evidence of strength. Now, Christian Babylon, Islam, and leftist atheism are the three big philosophies of the day, political philosophies. We need to be careful. By the way, I'll suggest that Christian Babylon, Islam, and leftist atheism may correspond to the beast, the false prophet, and the dragon. Those three unclean spirits of Revelation 16. Let's keep watching and see if it continues to work out that way. Meanwhile, we've got these three enemies. Don't let the sins of any two of them drive us to support the third enemy, which God is also destroying. 2 Timothy 2, verses 3 and 4. Suffer hardship with me as a good soldier of Christ Jesus. No soldier on service entangleth himself in the affairs of this life, that he may please him who enrolled him as a soldier. Is there a temptation to get out there to support this political party or that political party? Is there a temptation to get into the demonstration against this or against that? But if we are a soldier of Jesus Christ, our duty is first change ourselves from what we are to what we should be, and the Bible tells us what that is. And the second is to tell others what Christ has done, his sacrifice once for all. Therefore, all will benefit. And to tell the world what it is that the Lord is doing. In that regard, I like to tell people that the Lord has given the restoration of Israel as a concrete pledge that he will indeed establish his kingdom. Philippians 4:11, I have learned in whatsoever state I am, therein to be content. And Romans 12:17, render to no man evil for evil. Ever tempted otherwise? 1 Timothy 6:6, Godliness with contentment is great gain. So, trust God. Isaiah 26:9. When thy judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants of the world will learn righteousness.